Well, we seem to be at a tipping point moment. The U.S. dollar, de-dollarization, the U.S. dollar on the verge of collapse as the BRICS nations continue their march, moving away from the U.S. dollar. We can continue discussions about moving towards a central bank digital currency in the United States, getting us all into this dollar digital fever so we don't have cash anymore. Oh, yeah, they want to get rid of cash on top of it all. And, of course, the move towards Bitcoin standard and being able to have that freedom to transact the way that you want. All of these things seem to be coming ahead simultaneously, and we thought it'd be a great time to have on Mark Goodwin, who is the editor-in-chief at Bitcoin Magazine, author of the book The Bitcoin Dollar, to talk all about this. And Mark, welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Clayton, thank you so much. Yeah, big fan of Redacted. You guys do great stuff. It's an important show, and I'm very thankful to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for all of your great work on this and really educating all of us about this move towards digital currency. But I want to focus on a couple of different things today. I think stable coins is a big piece of this, and central bank digital currencies. So maybe we'll start with CBDCs here, central bank digital currencies. Sure. And I think your position has been that this is really a bit of like a red herring. You hear Senator Elizabeth Warren, huge fan of central bank digital currencies, getting us away from the U.S. dollar, moving towards a sort of a Wall Street backed digital version of a U.S. dollar. How do you see that coming together? Why do you think it's a bit of a red herring?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's definitely not the typical take. But I would say, in general, whenever I see, thought leaders and politicians, actually kind of picking up a trope that would seem to be for the people, right? There's a lot of movement these days of anti-CBDC, rhetoric, right? Whether they're political candidates, presidential candidates, or senators, congressmen. And whenever you see that, I think there's a reason, you should stop and say, hey, why do I agree with this senator here or this, VP pick or something? Why is that happening? And I think that's where the red herring idea comes up, where it's like, well, the dollar's been digital for a very long time, actually. The vast majority of dollars that are traded, these dollar liabilities, are digital dollars, whether they're Venmos or, credits between checkings accounts in private sector banks. The digital dollar has been here. It's been here for a long time. The main issue and the fear, which is rightfully so, of CBDCs is the programmability, the seizability, giving a government basically direct access to the mint and to be able to surveil basically the open ledger of a CBDC, that's where a lot of these issues come into play, rightfully so. But the private sector implementations of programmable money, which, as you brought up, that's what I would call these stable coins, it basically gives, the powers that be essentially the exact same mechanisms of control over our spending habits and over our data, without actually probably a lot of the restrictions they would have of being a public sector entity on customer access. So there's actually probably a lot more rules and a lot more rights they would have to give to citizens and users of, say, a government issued central bank digital currency versus a private sector. And we've seen this kind of play. This was really bunch of eye-opening work, and you guys reported on a bunch of this as well, but with Whitney Webb's work on kind of how the private sector has basically been taken over in many ways, this sort of private sector coup. The intelligence operatives have basically gone into venture capital and gone into the private sector because they reserve a lot more customer restrictions. A Venmo can or a PayPal can shut down your account quite easily, whereas a government issued version of that same thing would be a much bigger deal if they were to sort of restrict access because of freedom of expression. So this idea that the private sector is actually sort of a shield for these Incutel funded private sector companies and private sector banks, to be able to kind of, build this panopticon of programmable money. I think the private sector is a much better angle for them to take. It actually gives them a lot more opportunity to play their games. And so I think that the focus really from this, you know, resistance angle of this panopticon that is absolutely coming, like, well, let's look at how money is made now. You know, private sector, you know, banks are really where the dollars are created. They buy, you know, U.S. treasuries that they back the digital dollars in their checking, in their checking accounts. So yes, the U.S. dollar is the reserve asset of the world, the reserve currency of the world, rather. But the reserve asset is these treasuries. It's this. It's the debt that the U.S. sells to typically, supposedly, supposed to be foreign entities, foreign central banks. You know, China, Japan. You know, Germany. You know these foreign entities essentially is who's generally supposed to be buying sovereign debt. Now we look at who's buying sovereign debt. You know, the largest net buyer of sovereign debt in the last few years has been stablecoin issuers.
Really?
And it's because they can buy treasuries. Yeah. So right now, Tether has $110 billion of U.S. treasuries, which is like, you know, Japan has about a trillion. China's about a trillion. So that's like a tenth of the sovereign debt owned by our biggest creditors. In on the global scene. So this tiny company that has like, you know, 40 to 50 employees is buying U.S. treasuries at a bigger clip than China or Japan. So that's something that has to be considered. It's like, okay, well, you know, they're buying more treasuries than our biggest creditors. Why? And I think it's because that there is, you know, there's a play here basically to, you know, create a bunch of resistance against central bank digital currencies, and create a bunch of sort of, you know, populist encouragement and movement towards, hey, we resisted this thing. We got Trump and Vivek saying no central bank digital currencies. You know, even some people on the left are saying that it's a, you know, it would restrict human rights. And now we're getting kind of pushed into this. What comes in and fills the void? It's private sector. And so we're seeing this huge phase shift of, you know, the private sector is now being championed through the Malays, the Javier Malays coming and speaking at Davos, you know, saying how great the free market is and God bless the free market and all these things after, well, yeah, they've raided the treasury. They've taken our infrastructure. They've taken our assets, our commodities, and, you know, they've been basically gobbled up by these huge corporations. Sold to the highest bidder there. And now that the treasury's been raided, they printed trillions of dollars. You know, they locked down the country. They locked down the world in lockstep, really. Now that that's all happened, there's suddenly a 180 and we're getting people championing the free market at Davos. It's like, well, why? Because it's very useful for them to push us towards these private sector commodities and stable coins. So that's where I think the red herring angle kind of comes from. Is I don't think the U.S. government wants to make a central bank digital currency. I think they want to keep the banks that run the Fed, you know, these big four American banks that really do dictate financial policy, you know, they still want that lever. They still want that control. So they want to keep the capital creation in the private sector. And that's where I think we'll see stable coins grow to be trillions of dollars, a highly regulated stable coin, before we ever see any sort of direct issued CBDC.
Wow. I mean, you're blowing my mind here. So I think in some ways, you know, you say red herring and a lot of times we say false flag on this show. So sure. It's in many ways saying, hey, okay, look, you know, central bank digital currency, it's a great way for Elizabeth Warren to come out and talk about it. And then it's almost like good cop, bad cop to say, well, 100%. You know, We consulted with our Wall Street friends. We think it's better for the consumer to not have a federal program, a central bank digital currency, but it's better if Wall Street is backing these stable coins. Wall Street, the private sector, is involved in this process, and that's better for everyone. It's, you know, it's free market, it's capitalism, it's better for everyone. So look over here while we pull this off over here and really kind of sets you up good cop, bad cop. Against central bank digital currencies. It really has become the sort of the vilification of CBDCs over the past year. It's really, you've heard, you know, Donald Trump publicly saying it. You called that out. He said it at a recent libertarian event where he said he will stand to make sure that that does not happen. No central bank digital currency. Same thing in Florida as well. So I think you might be onto something here. But what about the Fed Now program? The Fed has already rolled out and been testing with JP Morgan Chase. How does that come into it? The Fed Now program, which we already heard is already kind of rolling out all of these pieces of the CBDC. Or is that conflating two different programs here?
No, I think it fits actually perfectly into the private sector capital creation concept of basically the private CBDC, private bank digital currencies, PBDCs, if you want to call them. Because all FedNow is an interbank settlement network. So it basically allows banks within the Federal Reserve System to settle the sale of treasuries or the exchange of treasuries. Or securities, really. But treasuries specifically, I think, it's the most liquid money market in the world, U.S. treasuries. So FedNow basically sets up an ability for the Federal Reserve System to create basically a white list of saying, okay, these are the banks in our system that can participate in, the FedNow system. And so what FedNow is really doing is basically re-onshoring dollar-denominated liabilities to the United States away from, you've probably heard this phrase, the euro-dollar, but away from all these dollar-denominated liabilities that exist outside of the purview of the Federal Reserve System. So trillions and trillions of dollars have been bounding around in the euro-dollar market for years, which actually doesn't rely on U.S. treasuries backing the dollar instruments that are being traded. There's this it's actually recently been retired, but you've heard of this phrase, the LIBOR, the London Interbank Overnight Rate. And basically, it was an overnight rate that was set for banks in the euro dollar market in Europe for when they're exchanging these treasuries. They would set the rate of yield that you get. So when a bank is cash poor but has a lot of treasuries, a lot of securities, they can do what's called a reverse repo. Repurchasing agreement with another bank, and they can exchange and say, hey, I need cash to, give some money to someone who's withdrawing their deposits. I'm going to give you some securities. You're going to hold on to them for the night. And then I agree to repurchase them in the morning, and you agree to sell them to me in the morning. And I'm going to pay you a little bit of a fee for doing that. And that LIBOR is basically the rate that was set in the euro dollar market for the price of lending money overnight for banks that were dealing in all of these dollar denominated liabilities. But they didn't actually have to hold U.S. treasuries being sold from the U.S. government. They could hold other sort of liabilities that they could exchange that weren't directly like sovereign debt from the United States. So we saw the euro dollar market become this humongous thing. We saw all of these dollar denominated liabilities moving around outside of the borders of the United States. So what FedNow really does is it takes back the power from this interbank overnight rate in London being set, by these bankers that have no connection to the United States Federal Reserve System. I think the only one on there that even is a U.S. bank was JP Morgan Chase. And now it brings it back to the United States, and it resets the cost of lending money, the overnight rate, brings it back to the United States under this thing called SOFR, the securitized overnight federal funding rate. So it brings everything back into the United States. It allows the U.S. government to set the lending cost of money overnight for these banks, and it makes it so that they can control who's in the system, who gets to buy and sell these securities, and then the yield, basically, that these banks get when they exchange securities. So I think it plays in perfectly into the stablecoin PBDC play because, again, this idea that the U.S. government doesn't want to have to do all of the hoopla of running a banking system for 300 million people, they'd rather just run a banking system for the few hundred banks. And really, as more and more of these regional banks have issues, they have these duration mismatches, and a lot of them have failed in the last 4 years. We've seen some of the biggest bank failures in U.S. history. As we see more of that, we're going to see more centralization towards the big four. We're going to see more power go to Wells Fargo, JP Morgan. We've seen that, and that's going to continue to happen. So FedNow basically just allows the players already in the US dollar system to re-onshore the dollar, bring all that dollar denominated liabilities back to the United States, and allow the Federal Reserve System to set the price of lending overnight. That makes these securities a lot more powerful.
Right. So in many ways, when we've been talking about the de-dollarization, you know, BRICS currency and so forth, and these countries are dumping US treasuries, in many ways, it almost doesn't matter, because now you have all of these, all of these stable coin buyer provider like Tether and others that are gobbling up US treasuries, and they're backing their coins, their quote unquote coins, with US treasuries. And so maybe is it premature to say we're seeing the death of the US dollar then? Because maybe the US dollar is sort of being resurrected in another way to live again through stable coins?
100%. I think the discussions that we're having right now are the exact same discussions that pundits that were paying attention were having at the turn of the 60s into the 70s, when we actually saw the Nixon shock and we went off the gold standard. What we saw was the creation of the petrodollar system. So we removed from this gold peg, this one-to-one of, you know, you can take your dollar and go to a bank and exchange it for gold. And what we did was we created a monopoly, basically, on the sale of petrol. We made an agreement with Saudi Arabia, and we said, you know, hey, anyone wants to buy oil, which is this energy commodity that the whole world needs if they want to industrialize and compete in the modern economy. If you want to buy oil, you got to buy dollars first. And so what we did is we created a net demand for dollars that anyone in Europe, anyone in Asia, anyone anywhere that wants to buy oil, they have to buy dollars first. So all of a sudden, now there's a net buyer for dollars. And we've loosely pegged it via this monopoly that's backed by, you know, military backing and regulatory agreements, basically. We created this petrodollar system, energy commodity backed by dollars. Right now, we're basically doing the same thing. If you look at Bitcoin as being an energy commodity, because it creates, and you need a lot of energy, excess energy, to actually mine the Bitcoin, to create the Bitcoin, to the way Bitcoins are issued, there's a heavy amount of computation needed to find the next block. And so, you know, the people that are actually able to compete in the block creation, which issues the new money for Bitcoin, you have to have a lot of energy. So if Bitcoin is sort of this energy remittance system, where if you have excess energy, you can use it to mine Bitcoin. So we've basically created the exact same mechanism of the petrodollar, except for the fact that the actual commodity itself is not oil. It's not kind of reliant on, the sovereign entities that are pulling it out of the ground. It's an anti-sovereign, it's an anti-state, anti-government, beyond government, really. Not so much anti, but just it's beyond it. This protocol, this sovereign protocol. And so we've basically recreated the same mechanisms of the petrodollar system by creating an in effect monopoly on the ins and outs of the Bitcoin system, where you use dollars. I mean, we think of Bitcoin priced in dollars. You want to buy Bitcoin. How do you buy Bitcoin? You have to go to an exchange. And how do you actually buy the Bitcoin? Well, you have to use dollars. You have to, you know, input dollars into your exchange, whether it's through a stable coin, whether it's, you know, through just like USD from Bank of America or something. But you deposit dollars to an exchange to buy Bitcoin. If you want to get out of Bitcoin, yes, of course, you can barter, which I recommend people doing, and, you know, allowing this to be a peer-to-peer sort of revolutionary experience. Yes. But for the vast majority of people using Bitcoin, you know, you sell into dollars when you want to sell out. So we've basically created kind of the same mechanism as the petrodollar. We created a net artificial demand for dollars by pegging this underlying energy commodity to the US dollar system. And now we have, I mean, they're literally calling it Tether, right? I mean, we have these stablecoin providers that are quite literally tethering the capital expansion of Bitcoin, which is a very interesting, Bitcoin has a lot of interesting properties that sort of are very important for the digitalization of the economy. In the sense of, you know, dollars are debt instruments. You know, that's something that we talk about a lot, right? I mean,
right.
They're debt instruments. Bitcoin is actually really the only digital credit that exists. There's a debt that you take from an energy standpoint to issue Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is digital credit, and it's the only digital credit that exists. All other instances of attempting digital currency are other just iterations of debt. Bitcoin is really the only digital credit. And the thing that's really interesting about Bitcoin is that it is demand inelastic, in the sense that as more and more people want it, the supply stays exactly the same. So the demand has absolutely no factor in how much of it is being issued. And that's quite different from oil. If there's huge demands for oil, which is what happened, the United States learned how to pull it out of sand, and how to, you know, the U.S. went from being, a net importer of oil in the 70s when this whole system started to now we're one of the biggest producers of oil. Gold is the same way. If you want more gold, the price of gold triples. You can send three more people into the mine the next day, and you can actually extract gold out of the ground faster because there's more demand for gold. The price goes up, you send more people in the mine, you bring more gold out, more gold hits the market, supply increases, demand decreases, and we have this sort of leverage, you know, it levels out. We have this sort of effect. Bitcoin, it doesn't matter how many people want it. The issuance is actually set in stone algorithmically.
Right.
So the more and more people wanting it, the rate of issuance stays exactly the same. In fact, the rate of issuance actually halves every 4 years. And so March 2020 is sort of the month that I say that the petrodollar died, in the sense of that was, you know, right during the, basically right before the lockdown started, we saw oil futures go negative. It was kind of this really big, weird story, but it's true. It did happen. And for like a second there, they were literally, you know, paying people
to hold their oil.
Yeah, money paying, to hold oil.
We'll pay you to oil. Keep our barrels of oil. Yeah, that's crazy.
Absolutely insane. And so, you know, I'm just over 30, right? I mean, my entire life has been basically, in the petrodollar system. You know, my whole, you know, growing up was, hey, the U.S. goes and invades people to, you know, oh, we found oil and some, oh, we, you know, that was the joke. That's the meme, right?
That's where
now all of a sudden, exactly. And then all of a sudden, March 2020, you know, they're paying you to take it away, right? Now, again, it was a futures market. That's not literally what happened, but literally that's what happened economically. And so what else happened there at that exact time? You know, we saw in September of 2019 a total collapse of the reverse repo market, which is kind of that mechanism I was explaining earlier. We saw huge settlement failures, and the Fed basically had to set up this new backstop to help out banks who were afraid to lend to each other. So that's 2019. That's fall. And then in the middle of 2020, the Bitcoin halving happened in May 2020. So right before right before this event happens, we see the country lockdown, the world lockdown, we see oil go negative, and getting prepared to print trillions and trillions of dollars, right? And so the mechanism there is the Bitcoin halving, the relative issuance of Bitcoin dipped below, in that halving cycle, dipped below 2%. And that's really important, because before that, mathematically, it was over 4%. And so that means that the expected inflation of the U.S. dollar, is 2%. So that's under the relative issuance of Bitcoin. The rate of gold coming out of the ground is about the same, 2 to 3%. So all of a sudden, within literally just a day, right, when the halving happened, Bitcoin's relative issuance goes, instead of being, 12.5 Bitcoin a block, it goes down to 6.125. And that relative issuance is now below the rate of gold coming out of the ground and the rate of inflation that the U.S. monetary system targets. So mathematically, the U.S. dollar, gold, oil is all inflating at a higher rate than the economic policy of Bitcoin is. And I think that's a very important, for this sort of, if we're looking at the digitalization of money is sort of an inevitability, all of a sudden we see from an energy commodity standpoint, the relative issuance of Bitcoin dip below the biggest financial barometers in the world. I mean, those are the biggest markets, right? The U.S. dollar, gold, and oil are sort of the biggest commodity economic markets in the world. And then, of course, we've seen everything since. We've seen trillions and trillions of dollars of stimulus. Now the U.S. debt is over $34 trillion. The actual cost of just upholding the service of the interest of this debt is outpacing the growth of our GDP. It's outpacing how much we pay for defense budget spending. We spend more money to keep the dollar alive than we do on the military that defends the dollar.
Wow. Wow.
That's obviously a breaking point, right? Something sort of has to give there. So I think in the very same way that pundits, the people paying attention in the 70s are seeing, oh, how can we go off the gold standard? This must mean the death of the dollar. We're in that exact same moment now. And I think if we've learned anything from the dollar system is they will do anything it takes to keep it alive. And yes, the US dollar system is very over-levered against itself, as that debt sort of runaway interest has shown. But it's also highly over-levered over every other fiat currency in the world as well. I mean, the U.S. dollar is incredibly strong right now versus all of these other, fiat currencies. So I sort of came up with this idea that, well, maybe this is the Bitcoin dollar system. And we're actually pegging ourselves to Bitcoin in much the same way we did the petrodollar system. And the mechanism that's going to actually economically connect them is going to be dollar-denominated stable coins, which are going to be backed by U.S. treasuries. There's nothing in the Bitcoin system that touches treasuries. There's no interoperability there. But by creating certain regulatory environments, such as capital requirements, like Basel III, so if we put in a regulation, which we are doing, that says for every liability you have on your books, which Bitcoin is technically considered a liability, you have to have a dollar token or some sort of dollar
representation
instrument. Exactly for the liability you have on your books. So if you're holding a bunch of Bitcoin and Bitcoin rapidly appreciates in price and you're under a regulatory regime that says you need to have $1 for every dollar of Bitcoin, you know, value that you have, now all of a sudden you're a net buyer of dollars because right. You have to buy dollars to uphold the expansion, the monetary capital expansion of Bitcoin price appreciation.
And then we just had the death of the petrodollar deal between Saudi Arabia and the United States, a 50-year deal, of course, that has now not been renewed and allows Saudi Arabia to seek and settle transactions in other currencies in addition to the U.S. dollar. And now suddenly here we come along a new facility that could be used to back and prop up the U.S. dollar with stable coins. And Senator Elizabeth Warren, she openly loves stable coins. She talked about it. You know, she's wants to go after other things, but she's like, oh, stable coins, the regulation there is very easy. It's a one-to-one. U.S. dollar, and we can track that, and it's a very easy thing to do. So they're already on board with this. I think you're right. I think this train maybe has already left the station.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now we're talking, you know, I mean, it's very, I mean, maybe not funny is not the right word, but when you look at 08, 2008, and you look at this crisis, and you look at the bailouts, pennies. I mean, just, you know, barely anything right. compared to what we saw with the CARES Act and you know, the massive stimulus we saw in the COVID era, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars. Where we're going to be able to service the debt, the $34 trillion plus, where we're going to need to see trillions of dollars of treasuries purchased to be able to service the debt of the United States, just the interest payments. We're going to need to see trillions of dollars.
How is it sustainable though? You have 34 every night on our show. We have up on our big board the national debt, which is 30, as you mentioned, $34 trillion. The interest on the debt alone by the end of this year would be over about $1 trillion, just the interest payments, as you pointed out. So how is that sustainable? And then how is that good for stable coins and Bitcoin? If the U.S. dollar has this massive amount of debt associated with it, and it doesn't seem like it's sustainable, is it bad for Bitcoin? Is it bad for stable coins if all of them are tethered to this sinking ship?
Well, it's really that the U.S. is arguably tethering themselves to Bitcoin, really, because Bitcoin is sort of there's a lot of talk about where it came from and who made it, and is it a U.S. intelligence operation? Is it a bunch of cypherpunks that came to, you know, is it China? Is it Russia? Whatever. In general, I sort of don't subscribe to the multipolarity agenda anymore, just after the kind of lockstep COVID response. You know, we saw the same response from Israel, Russia, China, the United States, Canada. I mean, anyone you want to mention that could be at odds, we saw essentially exactly the same response.
Yeah. Good point.
And so I sort of, you know, at this point, I'm kind of, okay, well, I don't know how much I buy that anymore. But I see the U.S. government really, let me rewind. It's irrelevant, I think, who created Bitcoin. I think what it is what's important. And there's a mathematical truth to it. And it's this brilliant economic policy that created digital scarcity in basically an infinite universe. And so how do you connect yourself to this digital scarcity, when you have a hyperinflating currency, a U.S. currency? And I think by creating this regulatory environment that creates a net demand for dollars and for treasuries when Bitcoin appreciates, you basically create the system where it's great for the U.S. dollar that there's a net buyer of U.S. treasuries. So the U.S. dollar loves Tether. The U.S. dollar loves Circle, loves the incoming PayYUSD, the PayPal stablecoin. It loves this because they're the biggest net buyers of U.S. debt. And so the U.S. government sets up a system that says, okay, well, we'll allow you to do your thing and be private capital creators. Basically, you know, create your own money. You're creating dollar tokens. All we require is that you buy, you know, our debt. And we'll let you pump this Bitcoin thing up to being a multi-trillion dollar market cap. We'll let you do that whole shebang, as long as when you hold it on your books, you consider it a liability, and we require you to hold an equal amount of some sort of dollar instrument that services the debt of the United States. Everyone wins. The Bitcoiners win because number goes up. They're all very excited. You know, they don't care so much that maybe the appreciation of Bitcoin is perpetuating the military-industrial complex. I think a lot of Bitcoiners are sort of naive to that. Right. That, you know, there's this whole idea that Bitcoin empowers all. It's like, well, great. Well, what if that person that's being empowered is not, you know, some unbanked person in the global south, but rather, Raytheon.
Raytheon, or, you know, Boeing. Some, or,
exactly, right? You know, yeah. Right, not to call them out. I have no idea what Raytheon thinks about Bitcoin. But just this idea that it's only empowering the little guy is kind of naive. It's like, well, no, it empowers anybody that touches it. And when we actually look at Bitcoin, where is all the Bitcoin? The vast majority of the Bitcoin is within the United States. The vast majority of publicly held Bitcoin and treasuries on balance sheets of companies are in publicly traded United States companies. A huge amount of the hash rate that actually creates the Bitcoin and solidifies basically the settlement of transactions in a block is within the United States. There's so much more to be lost if the United States loses the Bitcoin play that's sort of what we're seeing now. We're seeing Trump come out and go full-blown Bitcoin, and he wants he literally said, it's very Trump of him, you know, I want the remaining Bitcoin to be made in the USA, which is kind of this funny, like, you know, USA, but what does that actually mean? That means I want to see the remaining Bitcoin mined in the United States. I want to see a national mining rig. I want to see, whether it's the private sector or the public sector, we are going into Bitcoin mining and we're going hard at this thing. I want to see that innovation and that capital creation, you know, stay in the United States.
Wow.
So I don't think there's not really a surprise that we're seeing that. We're also starting to see whispers of the Biden administration kind of moving towards that. Seeing how it's such a powerful demographic, a powerful voting block, there's just too much to lose for the dollar system to not embrace this. So that's really where I look at. Yeah, I think the CBDC play, it will be interesting to see other countries, how they do their digital currency. I think that there is probably going to be international CBDCs, but I think for the dollar system specifically, we won't see a central bank digital currency that's retail facing. We might see some fun, you know, tokenized security settlement, basically tokenized U.S. debt treasuries that are exchanged, you know, through J.P. Morgan's private blockchain system. Or I think we might see some things like that. But FedNow, private sector stable coins, and then Bitcoin basically being the energy commodity that sits in the same way that petrol kind of sat in the 70s through, you know, 2020, basically. I think that, you know, triangulation will more or less sort of set up the digital economy as we move forward. I don't know exactly. You know, anyone that says they know exactly what's happening is lying to you. I don't know exactly what's going to happen. But to me, Bitcoin, this embracing of Bitcoin by, you know, the powers that be, I think shouldn't really be that much of a surprise from an American viewpoint when looking at, you know, these. And so, like, I wrote a book called the Bitcoin Dollar that basically sets up this analog of looking at interest rate manipulation and kind of the history of the US dollar system basically since the petrodollar. And I wrote the first, you know, chapter of this, the kind of the first idea in 2021 in the fall. And it basically was like, the US is going to totally lean into Bitcoin. Trump is going to talk about Bitcoin. Stable coins are going to be a huge way that they connect these pieces. And now we're seeing all of that happening. You know, when I wrote the piece, Tether was like $50 billion. Now they're like, you know, $120 billion, basically. We're seeing PayPal make its stable coin play. Private capital creation is a hell of a racket. You know, I mean, these guys, the bankers, have really run everything for a supremely long time. They basically run the government, frankly, through the way that they influence and lobby. The way that, you know, they're allowed to give money to politicians to get them elected, and then they get government contracts. And we're just, you know, we've seen this sort of carousel of private public sector capital creators. And now, you know, here we are at the forefront of, you know, really the digital economy. I don't think it should be that much of a surprise that, you know, Bitcoin is going red, white, and blue. And it's doing it through these stable coins.
Fascinating. This is a fascinating topic. It's unbelievable. I mean, maybe not unbelievable, but I think it makes a heck of a lot of sense, certainly for the United States government, certainly for Wall Street. And it seems the way that's being presented is a win-win really for everyone. Hopefully people will be aware of where some of this money is going. And if Raytheon and these other big military industrial complex players are involved in it, we'll have some awareness about that as well. Mark, yeah, I want to have everyone encouraged to go read your book, author of the Bitcoin Dollar. Go check out your book. Also read Bitcoin Magazine and learn more about what's happening right now. I think it's a fascinating time in the United States and around the world for this move towards stable coins. And I want to thank you for educating us all on this. You gave me a lot of things to think about. It's going to be some deep dinner conversations at my house with my wife over the next couple of weeks. So thank you for that, Mark. I appreciate it. What's something that you would encourage people to read right now or study up on? Is there a most recent blog post that you've put up there that people should dive into?
Yeah, I've been working on a series with you know, a friend of yours, with Whitney Webb, pretty much the best journalist of our era.
For sure.
And, you know, she's done a lot of work on this stuff before, you know, we started working together, looking at a lot of the tokenized security deposits and interoperability of CBDC systems. And we started writing together at kind of the end of last year. And we've put out a few pieces now on Unlimited Hangout and Bitcoin Magazine. So the last one was called Debt from Above. That was sort of about this, you know, private sector carbon credit coup that uses a lot of the players from the stablecoin world. So that's kind of the next system, is sort of tokenizing the real world and then backing them and denominating them in dollars. And so I think that's sort of the next play. They basically ETF'd Bitcoin, you know, as Larry Fink said, of BlackRock. We wrote a piece called Tokenized Inc. that was all about that idea of using a universal ledger to tokenize, you know, everything, you know, all commodities, all securities, everything. So we've written a couple of pieces now on kind of this idea. We're about to have another one out in a few weeks that focuses a bit more on the PayPal Mafia's implementation of this, which is quite interesting. So yeah, I would say read Debt from Above and read Tokenized Inc. They're both on Bitcoin Magazine and Unlimited Hangout, for sure. And then also, you know, not to be too much of a shill here, but really, I think just as a signpost, you know, I work for Bitcoin Magazine, which, you know, one of the affiliates of of BTC Inc., which is the company that runs Bitcoin Magazine, puts on this big conference every year. And this big conference, Bitcoin 2024, is in Nashville in July. And there's like double-digit percentage of senators that are that are coming to participate. And I mean, it's insane, the embracing of the public sector just so so clearly. And there's such a huge presence. Obviously, the private sector stuff, I think, is very obvious. Of course, they're going to be there. But there's so many senators and congressmen and political presidential candidates. And, you know, I think we're going to see more of that embracing by the public sector as this becomes a lot more politically popular. And I think the Trump pivot obviously was a humongous signpost. So, yeah, I would say, you know, check out those pieces and then, you know, take a look at who's coming out and talking about Bitcoin, which congressmen are kind of pivoting and moving towards it, who's going to be at the conference speaking. I think there's a lot to learn. It's going to be beyond bipartisan. I think it's as you know, former Speaker Paul Ryan just wrote in the Wall Street Journal, you know, stable coins, you know, can extend U.S. dollar hegemon. And that's going to become a very popular political position. So take a look at that and start noticing when you see political candidates coming out and championing Bitcoin or accepting Bitcoin for donations, you know, just be like, oh yeah, I see this Bitcoin dollar thing. Maybe there's something to it.
Mark Goodwin, editor of Bitcoin Magazine and author of The Bitcoin Dollar. Check out all of those things as well as the big conference here. And yeah, we'll be keeping our eye on which senators and presidential candidates are heading down to Nashville. Mark, great to have you here. Thank you for educating all of us on this. We really, really appreciate it.
My absolute pleasure, Clayton. Thanks so much.